Hello and welcome back to The Meaning of Life. This is the first episode that I've done since last summer. I do believe, if my memory serves me correctly, that the last episode I recorded was a location episode in the forest with my good friend Caius back in, may have been July, is my guess. I'll come back because I've neglected this part of my creative outlet, and I know nobody listens, and I really am genuinely happy about that. I hope nobody listens, and if you do listen, then it's because you like are my friend or family, or you like enjoy listening to what I'm talking about, you know. And it's like nice to have me in the background because you know me. If you don't know me, then I'm sorry for this. It's difficult being a creative person because there's always so many outlets to choose from, and all of them are just as valid as each other, but all of them require different emotional processes, you know? So, like, I've not been able to paint lately. I've gone off painting. It's difficult because in my brain, I'm like, I know what I want to paint. I know how to do it. I get inspired by paintings. Like, I saw paintings the other day on Instagram where it's, like, hyper-realism, and 9 out of 10 of the paintings are of women with water pouring down their faces, and it's like, apparently it's like a cliche, it's like a trope in the hyperrealism portrait art, because it's like such a, the water, you know, when you paint it, it's, I don't know, it looks, they're good anyway. But I was inspired by that, and yeah, I couldn't even paint. And I've not been able to read lately. I was really into reading the past couple years. Solid, like straight, and you know, a lot of reading about ecology and rewilding and natural philosophies and just science and journaling and politics and all that kind of stuff, all within the boundaries of wildlife. And yeah, like I've been reading bits of books here and there, you know, like I'm reading Isabella Tree's book, I'm reading a book called The Heartbeat of Trees, all these things. It's like I can't focus and read for like more than 10 pages at a time, and I always struggled with this my whole life. And then suddenly when I got into ecology, it like clicked for me, because I could read about something I actually cared about, and it was like a productive thing. I could use it for research. It was interesting to me. You know, like the first book I ever read about nature was How to See Nature by Paul Evans, and that book is absolutely instrumental in like how nature relates to nature within itself and how we're all part of it. It's a really good like philosophy book, really, with science and biology backing it. It's very good. And I can say the same about a book called In the Eye of the Wild, which is by Natasia Martin, who is a French anthropologist. And the story is a true story. She went on these journeys out to this camp in far east Siberia, out in the middle of nowhere. And she like lived with these people, these tribes. They live in like icy mountains and that. And she lived with them on and off, went back. And one time she was staying there for like a few weeks or months or something, just like journaling, because she's an anthropologist and she was studying these different cultures, right, of the Even people. And where they live, it's on this like peninsula that's surrounded by a jungle and forest and mountains. And one day she was walking out in this forest and she came face to face with a brown bear. And the whole book basically is around the trauma that she encountered with the bear. They like basically they had a fight and it ended in like an even stalemate, because the bear managed to do things like rip off parts of her face and like her jaw, but then she had an ice pick for climbing, and which is like a big long handle with a, you know, it's like an axe kind of thing, and she like just swung that into the side of the bear and then it ran off. They both survived. The bear probably survived, it's a bear. And basically the book is about a philosophy called animism, which is an idea that essentially derives from the base of all religion, but without the human organization. So it's the idea that energy can't be created or destroyed, right? Energy is a gift granted by God. And this energy is life, it's soul, it's spirit, it's animation, and it's animism. And basically, so it's the idea that, like, reincarnation is a thing, and all souls and spirits are interconnected because we're all from the same higher being. We're all part of the same, you know, cut from the same cloth, so to speak, like, celestially. So when you have, like, a relationship with an animal or a river, or, like, when you experience the energy, you know, the rumble on a volcano, it's the idea that the volcano and the river, they're alive. They're just as alive as the animal is, and the animal is just as alive as a human is, and everything is just everywhere there is animation and there is energy, there is life. And there's no boundary, there's a lot less boundaries between those forms of life, so like flora, fungi. The book follows her path of trauma from the healing of the physical trauma all around hospitals in Europe, and then the psychological healing from the trauma, but also, on the contrary, the bond that she formed with the bear. And that's where the animism comes in, and it's really fascinating. It's a lovely book because she writes about how this almost, this very poetic, it's a very poetic book, and she writes about how when she met that bear, when they locked eyes, there's like a kind of primeval built into our DNA, the bear, to sense of, like, when the eye contact is made with two apex predators, there has to be a fight, because then, you know, they can't both be in the same territory and they don't want to take that risk. That's like just how it works. And so she says that, like, spiritually, that created a bond, the idea that the two apex predators had this interaction, and that created a spiritual bond that she felt throughout the whole process and after the process. And then the book ends with her going back, after she's all healed up, going back and looking for the bear in the forest. But then she doesn't in the end. She decides not to, because she wants to stay with the family that she's, like, you know, come to love as her own family, or, you know, these tribes. The reason I feel confident in saying the story is because it's a true story. So, like, yeah, spoilers, but, like, still read the book. It's my favorite book. It's absolutely beautiful. I've made all my family read it. Those are books that I read, and now I'm struggling to, like, have that same level of clarity when it comes to reading and attention. Because things are tough out here. Like, being honest, I'm going through tough times because I'm struggling with kind of general stability and purpose. And I'm sure a lot of people, other people are as well, you know. I'm sure it's not just me, but it always often feels like that. In a sense of, like, less financially, because I'm never really financially motivated. As long as I have enough money to live, I don't find pleasure in buying things. I find pleasure in being places. I've been applying for lots of jobs, and I've had interviews. And I got really close, like, a few weeks ago. I got this interview with a decent company doing a decent thing. With decent, good pay, and just, like, good circumstances and a good situation, and it just seemed very, very fitting, and I was really excited for it. And, like, I had an interview, they were, like, extremely positive about it, and I had another interview, and they were extremely positive about it, and they gave me the job. And then I told everyone, and then the day after, or the same day, they sent an email saying, oh, we can't give you the job, sorry, can't say why. And it was soul crushing, because I spent so long, like, trying to sell myself and having to like prop up that ego and try to pick myself up from the ground every single time. And then I finally was like, people have recognized that I can do something and provide value, and I'm gonna be able to do it and get paid for it, and it'll be wonderful. And then it just got pulled out from like under my feet like that. And it's very difficult, and I'm still dealing with that in a way, you know, like it was rough. It was very rough for a bit. Now it's just like, it's a little bit mean, you know. It was very mean what they did. So where I can't find control with things like money and a job, I'm finding control where I can. So I've been trying, I have been to a certain extent, to improve my diet and my exercise. And I have put on weight, which is good. I went up from 69 kilograms to 76 in a few months, which I'm happy with. And I've put on a bit of muscle. I can, you know, I'm a bit stronger. I'm like quite a lot stronger, and it's quite nice. I'd recommend it. Like, if you feel bad about, not necessarily just how you look, but if you just feel generally worthless and you want to do something good for yourself to give you a bit of confidence, eat more protein and lift heavy things, because you do the thing and you're like, yeah, I can do it, and then you're like, oh, what if I can't do it, what if I'm like depressed or a failure? And then you get to the point of lifting where like it becomes, you know, you feel the burn, it becomes painful. And that's the part of weightlifting where it gets like burning, you know, it starts burning. That's the point where your muscle fibers start tearing and you get like a rush of blood to that area. And that's where muscle growth happens. That's the important part of like training. But also it's quite painful. But when you're doing it like, you know, for your mental health, when you're not in a wonderful state, it can be good because it gives you a kind of pain. So it's generally healthy, like for the body and the brain, because it means that you can do things. Like a few days ago, I like laid a fucking patio just because, you know, like why not? And I was like lifting these big heavy paving slabs and I didn't even really notice the weight. It was like fine. It was not that heavy and it was really cool. And like sometimes I go rock climbing, like indoor rock climbing and bouldering. And that's great because then I can pull myself up, just with my arms, you know, push myself, or I can like just, I just have better strength because I've been training my shoulders and biceps mainly, like not a lot, and I've not been eating enough protein, I've not been eating well enough, you know. I need to get better at that, but that is at least a positive in the list of updates. Another update is that I've bought a tarp recently. It's a 3x3 meter plastic tarp which has like 19 attachment points all around, and it's by a company called DD Hammocks. So it's like waterproof and you can arrange it in a multitude of different ways. I made this kind of like, you know, 3D triangle tent structure thing because I was like learning different structures to build, and I set it up in the back garden, and then I put in my bivy bag, inflatable sleeping mat and a sleeping bag. Well, I used a mattress because it was in the garden. Sorry, a duvet in the garden. Not a mattress. I didn't put a mattress in the tent. I was testing it for a camping setup, and I slept there the night, and it was wonderful. I even had my big camping backpack, and I put that in the corner of the tent, and it was like fine. And the reason this is so good is because it's like waterproof and windproof to a certain extent. It's pretty, it's like water resistant. There are gaps where the top bits don't properly zip up or meet because there are no zips. But it's like, unless there's a storm, no water's going to come in. And if there is a storm, it would just be a little bit. But I've also got a bivy bag, which is basically a big body bag, plastic bag, which you get in and you zip up, and that's waterproof. So if it came to it, I can just zip that up and it's fine. But the beauty of having the top is that I can sleep under that in the bivy bag, and the bivy protects me from the wind on my legs, regardless of what the tarp is doing. And it also means that if I can just zip it up quickly if it rains, and it's lovely. So that's positive news. And I'm going to go camping in the spring, in the summer. It's going to happen in April and May. I'm going to do it. I published a film a few weeks ago about the history of squirrels in Great Britain, in the British Isles. And I put it up. It did pretty well. I'm happy. It's got like a couple thousand views or something, which is nice. That means that 2,000 people, or 2,000 versions of different people. No, you know what I'm trying to say. Like, because it's not 2,000 different people. It could have been 1,000 people watching it twice. You don't know. Point is, it's nice. It's cool. It's a few people, and I appreciate that. When I made that, that was like, because I saw this thing where you have like people trying to kill a grey squirrel to save a red squirrel, and it like was just bizarre to me, and it shocked me. And it's also a story that's like close to home with me, because I grew up in East London, where the wildlife is red foxes, grey squirrels, and wood pigeons. And that is really about it. I've seen two frogs in the garden in my life, and that is really it. There were some parakeets there, because they're invasive. But the point is, squirrels and foxes and pigeons were like kind of really the wildlife that I grew up with. And so to me, when I grew up, a grey squirrel really was a native animal, because it was like around my home when I was a kid. That's like, you know, when you're a little kid, that's kind of how you view things. So when I grew up and I learned that they're not native, I was like, oh, interesting. And then a few months ago, I started really, really reading into the extent to which people properly try to eradicate grey squirrels. There's like political movements, you know. People are very, very passionate. And there's also people that are trying to save grey squirrels in England. And they're setting up these like Facebook groups, and it's kind of like it's illegal, because it's like against the law. There are all these laws, like the 1981 Wildlife and Countryside Act. They're harboring these grey squirrels, which it's against the law to release into the wild. And it's also against the law to keep captive without a license. So they are actually the ones that are breaking the law. And the people that are shooting grey squirrels with air rifles are the ones that are following the law, which I find to be a really interesting story. I don't support all of it, but I also do. It's a complex issue. But basically, like, that film was fun to do. I interviewed some people. I interviewed a lady who really, we didn't get on. She was very standoffish. She was very passive-aggressive. But she was very clever, and she was very resourceful, and she was very helpful. And there was another lady who was like, she was lovely. And they, both these people, they like worked with, one of them worked directly with red squirrel conservation, and the other one works more in regards to grey squirrel eradication, in regards to red squirrel conservation. It's the kind of thing of like, killing one animal to save the other, like I said before. So, like, it's very political, and there's a lot of things. So, I published that all around all these groups, all these, you know, so like these groups of people. I joined these, like, I kind of infiltrated these private groups on Facebook and these group chats and that, and then I published my film into them, where I basically rip apart and analyze everything they do, and I'd like analyze things from objective points of view, but kind of like data driven. Everything is referenced, you know, so like I'll read a lot of books and I'll do interviews, I'll watch interviews, I'll conduct interviews, I'll listen to interviews, I'll read publications, I'll read articles, I'll read laws, I'll read published deeds, I'll read bills, I'll read contracts, anything like that. But yeah, then I'll publish it on this, on these Facebook groups, and then people get very involved and they're very passionate, because it's like, you know, you're driving it directly to one of the target audiences, and then it becomes polarizing. And it's interesting because there are some, the most polarization happens when you have people that aren't really too in tune with the whole ecological debate in terms of widespread ecology and botany and how it all relates and the general health and biodiversity of the country, and they just kind of don't want to see a grey squirrel die because it's a cute fluffy animal. And I understand that, I do deeply, deeply understand that, and I kind of agree. I find it deeply sad and deeply unethical when a grey squirrel dies at, you know, from a bullet, from a gun, from a human being using a weapon. I don't agree with that. What I do agree with is that act of murder and consummation being done by a predator like a buzzard or a pine marten or a goshawk or a wolf or anything like that, really. I want to see more people educated on the general life cycle and food cycle of nature, just so we can see how truly, truly fucked up it all is right now. And it's why certain populations are skyrocketing and certain populations are plummeting. It's because all of this has been interrupted by unnecessary culling, by hunting, by decimation. And right now, there are only a few red squirrels left. So what we need is we need widespread reintroductions of these animals, of these predators. And sure, continue the shooting, but maybe tone it down and then let the animals do the work. That's how I view it, right? And the film, it goes into all of that. But a lot of people don't agree with that. And a lot of people just, like, get very angry. So I had some, like, nasty messages from it. I had some lovely messages too, but I also had some very aggressive messages. So I don't know how I feel about that one. I filmed a kestrel a few days ago. That was really good. I was sat on a little mound and I was like, that's a falcon. No, it's not. It's a falcon. No, it's not. Buzzard? No, kestrel. It was really cool. Beautiful, lovely bird. I went to the charity shop and I bought some OS maps. One of the maps I got was of the Forest of Dean. I got one of Snowdon and one of Ben Nevis, but the Forest of Dean one, I went through with it with highlighters and pens, and I annotated the fuck out of it. I highlighted all of the kind of all the viewpoints, all of the places I want to visit, all the cool spots, all the houses of people I know, all of the water sources, the springs, the wells. I highlighted all of the pathways and the tracks and the abandoned railway lines, all the, you know, all the good views, all the good camp spots. I highlighted the points of wildlife, of nice trees. It's really fun. I love doing it because it's like a big, big map. It opens up like probably, you know, 2 meters by something. And it's really fun. I'm excited to use that because I do love using a map and having it. It kind of like gamifies life because you have a map when it's a custom map, right? So you have like, you're holding a map and you have, oh, that's where I am. And you know, and what you know, if you put your finger down where you are, you go, oh, I'm not that far from this thing or that thing that I've been meaning to visit, or like, I think I might like, you know? So like you highlight something on the map and then it's almost like, it's the equivalent on Google Maps of like dropping a pin or setting a reminder to like go somewhere or do something. But it's just fun because you get to like do it with highlighters and you feel kind of almost like I felt my GCSE geography coming back. I really recommend it. It was almost like as therapeutic as painting. And I'd argue like it's in the same vein as painting, because you have this like beautiful piece of art, which is an OS map. Also, I forgot to mention, the map is from 1977, so it's like really cool. It's very like vintagely written, as in the things listed are like, there's more attention paid to like things that would have been more common in the 70s, you know, like certain shops, certain buildings, certain, you know, like roads, because some of the roads have changed a little bit. But generally, it's exciting because there are all of these springs, like natural springs and wells, hundreds and hundreds of them, and I've highlighted every single one manually, and I'm gonna go to all of them and look for the well, look for the spring, because they might not be there anymore because it's been 50 years. But I do think it's worth trying. The thing that I find difficult is I have flawed perceptions of time. So everything to me feels permanent, no matter how temporary it is. Even if I'm being told it's temporary, even if it is temporary, it feels permanent. Everything feels permanent. And that's always like, in moments of joy, oh, it's amazing, because like, you know, if I'm in like a good relationship, or I'm just having like a great day or a lovely holiday, it feels like that joy is never going to end. And it's amazing. But then when I'm going through periods of turmoil and a bit of aimlessness, like now, it's the opposite. It's the feeling of dread and suffocation that feels like it's never going to end. And it's funny because both are like so intense, but they're so polar. And I don't really know why that is. I do sometimes, when I have like periods where I'm like within that elation, because things are good, I try to like kind of, you know, invest that happiness into the future, and then kind of like hunker down otherwise in less productive times. But I think I'll be okay. I've sown some seeds for the spring, which is great. I've sown a lot of wildflowers, like foxgloves and sweet William and I forgot how you pronounce it, delphinium, I think. I've sown catnip and lavender, and then vegetables and herbs and things like peppers and kale and thyme and onion, lettuce, carrot. I think rosemary, tomatoes, Brussels sprouts, courgettes, and parsnips, I think. Yeah, parsnips. So it's like a nice amount of things to get growing. I love watching little plants grow because it's like just such a heartwarming thing to see that carbon be sequestered into a living being. It's great. I just really love it. Beautiful. I do view a lot of plant growing as that very thing. Like, even if you grow a plant and it dies, it's fine, because what you did is you took the carbon out of the air and you locked it into a solid thing, and then that will just get composted down and that carbon will go back into the soil, and that's totally fine. That can definitely happen. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a good thing. So, like, when I grow a plant and then it dies, I don't see it as a failure. I see it as a success, because I achieved what I wanted to long term. The main reason you grow a plant is for the health of you know, living beings. And yeah, you're, in one way, you're helping to achieve that goal. I know it doesn't really count, it doesn't really matter, but if everybody thought the same way, then maybe it would count and it would matter. But I'm a dreamer. So I'm going to say goodnight. And thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Meaning of Life. I have been your host, Craig Baker, and it's been interesting. I hope you're well. Text me. Let me know how you're doing, okay? I want to hear from you. You've got my number. Come on. Okay. Good night.